Welcome to Transformed by Grace, an in-depth Bible study of God's Word presented by the Berean Bible Society. Join us each time on this station as Pastor Kevin brings the transforming message of God's grace revealed through the Holy Scriptures.
Cowboy walked out of the mercantile and suddenly came running back in. He stood up on a counter and he yelled, "Now who here went and painted my horse blue?" Nobody answered. Then he pulled out his two guns and yelled even louder, "Which no good rotten scoundrel had the nerve to paint my horse blue?" Finally, a burly, imposing, towering 6 foot 8 inch tall wrangler holding a double-barrel shotgun and a stick of dynamite sauntered over and gruffly said, "I've done it. I'm the one who painted your horse blue." The cowboy looked at the man and said, "I just wanted to let you know the first coat is dry." Speaking of a no-good, rotten scoundrel, we'll be introduced to one in this portion of the book of Esther as we'll look at the rise of Haman. Esther chapter 3, verses 1 to 6 read, "After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Then the king's servants which were in the king's gate said unto Mordecai, Why transgressest thou the king's commandment? Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman, to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai." Verse 1 begins with the words, "after these things," which refers to after Esther became queen and after Mordecai had saved the king from assassination. Barry David wrote the following, "Life for the Jews in exile could not have been much better. One of their own was queen, although most would not have been aware of that fact, and one of their own had just rescued the king. All of that, however, would quickly change. The Jewish stock on the Shushan Board of Exchange, which in chapter 2 reaches all-time highs, plummets in chapter 3 to all-time lows." The important thing to take note of here in verse 1 is that Mordecai had saved the king's life, as detailed in the last verses of chapter 2. But his service to the king had been completely overlooked, and Mordecai was not rewarded or even thanked. We do, however, find that someone received a reward and a promotion in verse 1 of chapter 3, but it is not Mordecai. Rather, it is one who came out of nowhere and who probably flattered his way into the position, a man by the name of Haman. Verse 1 says of Haman that he was the son of Hammedatha. His father's Persian name meant given by the moon. Haman's name means magnificent or well-disposed. Verse 1 adds that Haman was the son of Hammedatha the Agagite. Because Haman was an Agagite, some Bible commentators and teachers have made the connection that he might have been descended from Agag, king of the Amalekites, who lived 600 years earlier than the events of Esther, at the time of Israel's first king, King Saul. In disobedience to God, King Agag had been spared by Saul when he destroyed the Amalekites, but he was later slain by the prophet Samuel. It is a possibility that Haman was a descendant of the kings of the Amalekites. What seems more plausible is that archaeologists have uncovered an inscription which indicates that Agag was the name of a province in the Persian Empire. This more likely explains why Haman, a high-ranking Persian official, was called an Agagite. Also, Haman, by his own Persian name and the Persian names of his sons, given in chapter 9, and the Persian name of his father, Hammedatha, all make it seem more likely that Haman was a genuine Persian. As far as his name goes, he could have been called Haman the Hateful. As we'll see, everything about Haman was hateful. The book of Esther portrays Haman as having all seven of the things that Proverbs 6:16-19 tells us that the Lord hates. These six things doth the Lord hate, yea, seven are an abomination unto him: a proud look, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, and heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, feet that be swift in running to mischief, a false witness that speaketh lies, and he that soweth discord among the brethren. While we don't know why Haman was promoted, we do know how high he was promoted. The king set his seat above all the princes that were with him. The word seat refers to his authority, and to Haman was given great authority. In chapter 1, we are introduced by name to the seven princes of Persia and Media, which saw the king's face and which sat the first in the kingdom. King Ahasuerus had a trusted seven-man council of advisors who had special access into his presence and who had been ranked highest in the kingdom. But here we find that Haman is advanced past these seven men, promoted to the highest possible office in Persia, to chief officer next to the king. With his appointment, the king had issued a special edict commanding that Haman be reverenced by other nobles, court officials, and magistrates which sat in the king's gate. Due to Haman's high position in Persia, they were all to bow and pay homage to him. In Esther 2:19, we learned that Mordecai had at some point been appointed to an official position in Persia's judicial system, and so Mordecai was one who sat in the king's gate. But as Haman came through the king's gate on a daily basis, verse 2 says, Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Mordecai refused to obey the edict of the king, and he would not bow when Haman went by. Years prior to this, Queen Vashti refused to obey the king's command, and it cost her her role as queen. Mordecai was aware of what could happen with disobeying the king's command, but he was willing to count the cost. This shows the degree of Mordecai's resolve to not bow to Haman. The fear of God overcame any fear of man to him. The words bowed and reverenced in this verse refer to prostrating oneself in worship. Had this command meant only civil reverence, the king would not have needed to command it, and nor would Mordecai have refused it, most likely. Because you find examples in Israel's history of men bowing before other men and showing due respect to those in authority, such as when David bowed before Saul. And the law of Moses also did not forbid this. But the Mosaic law did forbid the worship of any but Jehovah God. There was, therefore, some kind of divine honor intended in the king's requirement to worship and pay homage to Haman, such as was paid to the Persian kings. When the Persians bowed before their kings, they paid homage to them as a divine being. And this kind of divine worship was to be extended to Haman as King Ahasuerus' representative and second in command. And at that, Mordecai, a faithful, believing Jew, refused to worship Haman, remaining loyal to God and his word that God alone must be worshipped. Mordecai's own answer to those who asked him why he did not bow And why he transgressed the king's commandment in verse 4 was because he was a Jew. Mordecai refused the required prostration and reverence on religious grounds as a Jew. Verse 4 tells us that daily the other court officials hounded Mordecai about this because every day Mordecai refused to bow and give reverence to Haman as he went by in the king's gate. They daily questioned him and urged him to obey the king's commandment, but Mordecai hearkened not unto them. He would not listen or obey them. At a certain point, after trying for some time to get Mordecai to bow, the other officials in the king's gate decided to take the matter directly to Haman himself to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand, or in other words, to see whether his words would stand as valid. In other words, they wanted to see whether his answer that he was a Jew was a valid and acceptable reason for his behavior and for his refusal to give reverence to Haman and disobey the king's command. But these men also knew perfectly that they would stir up trouble in letting Haman know, because Haman had not even noticed until after he was told. We can be sure that these men were seeking to gain favor in Haman's eyes by doing so, too. Now, having his attention called to the fact, the next day when Haman saw for himself that Mordecai bowed not, he was furious, hot with anger, and full of wrath. What fills a person ultimately will control them, and wrath controlled Haman here. And Haman's pride, it infuriated him beyond reason. He was so angry that he thought scorn, or he disdained the thought of laying hands and executing just Mordecai alone. Haman could have simply reported Mordecai's refusal to obey the king's command to Ahasuerus, and the king would have likely imprisoned or even executed Mordecai. But Haman's vengeance would not be satisfied by destroying just one person. His hatred had to be satisfied by something much bigger. And knowing that Mordecai was a Jew, he now wanted to destroy Mordecai's people, all the Jews in the entire Persian Empire. In this wicked desire to destroy the Jews, it's been said, Haman was being satanically used to target the entire Jewish race in an unsuccessful attempt to change the course of redemptive history and God's plans for Israel. In all of this, we find that Haman is a picture of the future Antichrist in the tribulation period. Like the Antichrist, Haman came into power peacefully. Haman was promoted, advanced, and given great authority by the king. And likewise, the god of this world, Satan, will one day give great power and authority to his Antichrist, exalting him higher than all others. Like King Ahasuerus with Haman, Satan will demand that all give reverence and divine worship to the Antichrist. But like Mordecai, the godly Jewish remnant of the last days will refuse to worship him. This will infuriate the future Antichrist, and in his hatred, he will attempt to exterminate and destroy them all. Esther 3:7 to 11 reads, "In the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is, the lot, before Haman from day to day and from month to month to the 12th month, that is, the month Adar. And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore it is not for the king's profit to suffer them. If it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed. and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business, to bring it into the king's treasuries. And the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the Jew's enemy. And the king said unto Haman, the silver is given to thee, the people also, to do with them as it seemeth good to thee. Before wicked Haman in his rage took his plan to the king to destroy all the Jews, he first, with the help of the court astrologers and magicians, chose to cast lots to superstitiously select a day for the event. In verse 7, we learn that in the month Nisan, which is our March and April, in the 12th year of the reign of King Ahasuerus, or 474 BC, they, or the astrologers and magicians, cast pur, which is the Persian word for lot. Casting lots basically meant to shoot or throw dice. The astrologers and magicians cast the lot with Haman present from day to day and from month to month to the 12th month, that is the month Adar. This does not mean that for a whole year they threw dice in front of Haman. Rather, it means that the casts that they made stood for a different day and month to determine the day and the month within that calendar year. And the lot fell on the 12th month, which was the month Adar, or in our February and March. Verse 13 of this chapter adds that the lot also fell upon the 13th day of the 12th month. This gave the Jews time, almost a year, to prepare themselves, and it gave Mordecai and Esther time to act. Again, this shows God working behind the scene. Proverbs 16:33 reads, "The lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord." Like when the superstitious sailors in the great storm on the Mediterranean Sea cast lots to determine for whose cause this trouble had come upon them, and the lot fell on Jonah, the Lord was in control and at work here in this casting of lots here in Esther. In verse 8, after Haman had cast lots and arrived at a date for the extermination of the Jews, he brought his plan before the king, seeking his permission to kill them all. Haman presented his plan as if he only had the king's good at heart, and he hid his prejudice and his hatred. Haman did not divulge, and he craftily omitted the fact that it was the Jewish people he was speaking about, as he speaks of them only as a certain people. But the king also failed to be interested or involved enough to even care to ask. Haman gave an inflammatory report to King Ahasuerus about this certain people, misrepresenting them as a danger to the entire empire. He presented the king with half-truths and did not tell the whole story. And like Satan, Haman was a murderer and a liar. He stated, and it was true, that they were scattered and dispersed throughout all the provinces of his kingdom. But he mentioned this fact to make it seem perilous to not do something about them because they could adversely affect the whole empire. He stated, and it was true, that their laws are diverse or different from all people. Their laws were different because they were God's chosen people who alone had received God's holy law, the righteous standard of God from his own hand. As Moses told Israel in Deuteronomy 4:8, "And what nation is there so great that hath statutes and judgments so righteous as all this law which I set before you this day?" But then Haman exaggerates, lies, and falsely accuses all the Jews, stating, "Neither keep they the king's laws." One man, Mordecai, had dared to disobey one law, but Haman used that to falsely accuse all the Jews and that they all disobey all the laws of the land. Haman told the king that for these reasons and due to their disloyalty, it was not in the king's best interest to suffer them or to let them remain. He then requested that if it pleased the king, to let it be written or decreed. As Esther 1:19 said concerning Vashti's removal, let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes that it be not altered. Once a decree was written and given by the king, it could not be changed or reversed according to Persian law. And Haman desired that the king give an irreversible decree concerning these people that they may be destroyed, that they all might be killed. Then to encourage that this decree be made, Haman offered the king a very large bribe, telling him, "And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasuries." Being a man of immense wealth, and perhaps the wealthiest man in all of Persia, Haman said he himself was willing to bear the costs involved in carrying out this decree and for the privilege of ridding the kingdom and the king of these dangerous people. He offered the king 10,000 talents of silver, which is equal to 375 tons, 750,000 pounds, or 12 million ounces of silver. The current price per ounce of silver is around $30, which meant that this amount of silver is worth about $360 million today. After hearing the report of a rebellious people in his kingdom, and noting the generous offer of the money, the king, without asking any questions and being far too trusting of Haman, gave his royal signet ring to Haman. Giving this ring to Haman gave him executive power to act in the king's name, and it gave him the ability to write any decree he pleased, and to then put the king's seal on it. Giving the ring demonstrated the king's approval, and then the king voiced his approval, first telling him, "The silver is given to thee," meaning that he was telling him to keep his silver and that the king would pay for it himself. And then he further told him that these people were also given to him to do with them as it seemeth good or right or pleasing to thee. The king did so, likely believing that he had merely agreed to the execution of a group of dangerous radicals in his kingdom, not knowing that he had just approved a decree that had far-reaching effects and which would kill his own queen. Esther 3:12-15 reads, "Then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month, and there was written according to all that Haman had commanded unto the king's lieutenants, and to the governors that were over every province, and to the rulers of every people of every province according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus was it written, and sealed with the king's ring. And the letters were sent by posts into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. The copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people, that they should be ready against that day. The posts went out, being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan the palace, and the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city Shushan was perplexed." As Haman's evil plan moved forward, verse 12 tells us that the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month to write a decree about the Jews' extermination on the 13th day of the 12th month. Verse 12 gives us a picture of the comprehensiveness of the decree. the decree was written to and distributed to the king's lieutenants or satraps, governors and rulers of every people of every province of the Persian kingdom, and was translated into the various languages of the peoples within the empire. It was written in the king's name and sealed with the signet ring of the king. It was then sent by posts or couriers throughout the whole realm of Persia. The decree stated that all Jews of all age groups, young and old, including young children and women, should be destroyed and killed in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar. The decree further stated that the property owned by the Jews was to be plundered, and this prospect of spoil, money, and land provided incentive for the decree to be obeyed. Copies of the decree were published, posted, and made publicly available to all people in every province of Persia, commanding all to be ready for this day. Verse 15 tells us that the couriers quickly carried the decree to every part of the empire according to the commandment of the king, and it was published in the Persian capital city of Shushan as well. Verse 15 also gives us two extremes to the news. The king and Haman, they could send out a commandment decreeing the deaths of thousands and thousands and even millions, and then uncaringly and happily sit down to drink. While they were unconcerned, the city of Shushan was concerned and bewildered at the news of such extreme and deadly measures being taken against people of the empire, and they wondered what had caused it. To this day, the Jews have never forgotten Haman. They were reminded of this wicked man each year at the Feast of Purim. Walter Adeney wrote the following. During the dramatic reading of the Book of Esther in a Jewish synagogue at the Feast of Purim, the congregation may be found taking the part of a chorus and exclaiming at every mention of the name of Haman, "May his name be blotted out," while boys with mallets will pound stones and bits of wood on which the odious name is written.
Thank you again for tuning in to Transformed by Grace. We appreciate your prayer support and the financial gifts. The purpose and mission of the Berean Bible Society is to help you understand the whole counsel of the Word of God. For more information, visit our website at www.bereanbiblesociety.org or give us a call at 262-255-4750. Or if you prefer, write us at the Berean Bible Society, P.O. Box 756, Germantown, Wisconsin, 53022. Now until next time, may you be transformed by God's grace.